This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's a special pre-election edition of the Local News Roundup, and we've gathered our roundtable reporters at Birdsong Brewery in Noda. Yes, internally and on placards on the tables, we are calling this Brews and News. But I was just told there will be no consumption of anything other than water until we're done examining the key races, candidates, and issues on the ballot for next week's election. This seems hardly fair to me. We're about to elect Charlotte's sixth mayor in 4 years, but there are city council races to consider, and no matter the outcome, the makeup of council will change. The same is true of the school board. We'll get into that and other things that you should be thinking about before you cast your vote. And we are joined right to left now by Tom Bullock from WFAE News.
Hi, everybody.
Eric Spanberg is a chief senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal.
Hello.
Ann Doss Helms covers education and many other things for the Charlotte Observer.
Hello.
And Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to all of you. So we have, let's start with the mayor's race. We have two candidates for mayor, Vi Lyles, the Democrat, the mayor pro tem, Kenny Smith, the Republican, and the member of city council. They've had two debates recently, one on this program a week ago or so, and then one just this week on WBTV. Anything different, substantially different, emerge from those candidates at those two debates?
That's a really good question. I think incrementally, Mike, to be honest, I think you'll see kind of a refining of the messages that each candidate thinks are working for them or will work for them. But the core issues really haven't changed a whole lot. We knew going in that regardless of who the likely Democratic candidate was going to be, whether it was Mayor Jennifer Roberts or Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles, that Kenny Smith, the Republican, was going to go after some very similar themes, right? Going to go after the LGBT ordinance that expanded LGBT rights, going to go after kind of the war with Raleigh, between Charlotte and Raleigh, going to go after some pretty, you know, some issues that actually do tie Jennifer Roberts and Vi Lyles together. Vi Lyles, I think, in this most recent debate, did show a little bit, a little something different that she hadn't before, and that was pushing back against some of the ads that Kenny Smith has been running, pushing back against some of the negative ads. And you can agree or disagree with her point, but the fact that she is standing up for that is at least a change, because before that, Vi Lyles' tone in the debates had been very measured, very controlled, very non-confrontational.
And I was just going to say, and I think we're also getting into the leadership style. You know, we're hearing a lot of that. The issue that Tom didn't mention, he's right about all those issues, but you have to think about the riots and the protests and the response, how Jennifer Roberts in particular dealt with not just the media, but how she dealt with then-Governor Pat McCrory and the declining of the National Guard. So I think those issues have also come into sharper relief in the last couple
weeks. She did talk about the negative nature, what she viewed as the negative nature of the campaign during the WBTV debate. And she said, as a mayor, you have a responsibility to be positive. And Kenny Smith responded that he was simply talking about the issues. So who's right? Has this been a negative campaign?
I think he was correct about his own ads. There have been some ads that have been run by outside parties, and the most intensely negative one that we've seen has been from the North Carolina Values Coalition directed against Vi Lyles. Kenny Smith did not directly sponsor that. They can't communicate with groups like that and coordinate messages. So I think challenging each other on issues is indeed a valid form of campaigning.
And I think it also drives people crazy to hear that answer. You hear candidates on both sides of the aisle do that constantly. Yes, technically the campaign cannot coordinate with these outside groups, but there seems to be a wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of relationship.
Glenn.
I think if you compare this campaign to some other races, it might not seem particularly nasty. But as Charlotte races go, it really is rather contentious. Charlotte races typically are not, typically voters struggle to differentiate one candidate from another. I think this time around the line is a little bit more clear, and I think they have gone after each other just a little bit more, or especially Kenny Smith has gone after Vi Lyles a little bit more than we've seen in the past, which isn't a bad thing. I think we need candidates who can differentiate themselves a little better.
Hmm. Tom.
I agree with Glenn. I also think it's a bit of a presumptuous statement that was made by Vi Lyles, because she's not mayor. And we're not in being mayor mode. We are in campaign mode. And honestly, you know, you're going to hear two different sides of this. And I think both sides have merit. One is, this is a compare and contrast kind of ads. And specifically, when it comes to ads that Kenny Smith has run himself, there is the ad about the toll lanes, the I-77 toll lane projects and proposed other toll lanes, where he directly links Vi Lyles' votes. That's record.
Right.
Their take on that record can be a twist. Their take on that record, and nobody is going to be surprised by this, politicians will take a bit of a fact, regardless of party, and twist it into an ad that best works for them. But let's also not forget the fact that in the last televised debate in the Democratic primary, Vi Lyles also came out and in a nicer way, but did attack Jennifer Roberts. So she clearly knows this is the game. So you shouldn't just complain about the rules. You clearly understand them.
He was planning to run, of course, against Jennifer Roberts. How ugly would it have gotten had he had that opportunity?
Oh, I mean, I think it would be much more contentious. I mean, clearly the ad that the North Carolina Values Coalition ran trying to turn Vi Lyles into Jennifer Roberts, that tells you where this campaign right. was going. The other thing is, just to play off what Tom was saying, I mean, the whole idea, not only is she not mayor, but by the way, once you get through with campaign mode, has anybody been watching politics around here the last couple of years? When you're mayor, there's not much difference.
Yeah. So this is a Democratic city, or so they say, but the mayor's race is split. I mean, really evenly split. Spectrum News, which is the cable news network, showed that Lyles has 41% of likely voters. Smith has 40% of likely voters, and the margin of error is nearly 5 points. Kenny Smith has a large campaign chest. He's had it all along, outraised her from the very beginning. He's been spending money on TV and digital. I think Vi Lyles' first television ads of the campaign started this week,
yep.
a week before Election Day, when I guess early voting went into full swing. And at last report, she'd only spent about $11,000, mostly on radio ads. He spent $287,000 since August, $538,000 in total. Is the tightness of this race because of all the money?
I'll take a shot at that. Part of it is, but there's also something that's really interesting. We're sitting in front of a crowd, so I'm going to ask you guys a little patience here. Raise your hand if you've voted already, if you're an early voter. We've got a few in the crowd, not a ton.
Not many. How many of you plan to vote?
That's good to see.
Almost everyone.
That's good to see. When it comes to money, there is an advantage in a city like Charlotte. Now, you know, we're used to Charlotte being a majority Democratic city, but if you look at the current numbers, the current registration numbers, Charlotte remains a plurality Democratic city, but you know, you've got, 48% Democratic registered voters, 21 or 22% Republicans.
And the rest are independents.
30%. Yeah, 30% unaffiliated. Now, think about for a second. I'll ask for a raise of hands again. Who here considers himself or is registered unaffiliated? A good section of people, actually, a really good section. Now, the interesting thing about unaffiliated voters is you guys drive, and I'm one of you, so I will say me too. We drive campaign strategists bonkers. Because there's no loyalty to party. It's more based on either personality or issues. So when you look at early voting that's already taken place, and this goes on through Saturday, what you find is Democrats are outperforming their demographic by about 6 points. Republicans are outperforming their demographic by 2 or 3 points, maybe a little more. Unaffiliateds in this city have skyrocketed, and that means nobody knows where we stand in this race. So those ads can make a difference. Stances on issues can make a difference because we are becoming less and less reliant on parties, which means candidates have to sell points and issues more than just attacking
opponents. Well, if 48% of the electorate is allegedly Democrat and 21% are allegedly Republican and the 30% in the middle are independent, and yet the race is tied 40-40.
With 40% undecided.
Right.
Yeah, well, remember, a couple of things here. I mean,
Does that mean that the undecideds are leaning Republican?
We don't know yet. But the reason I bring up the early voting is because Democrats are the ones who tend to take advantage of early voting. Republicans tend to take advantage of mail-in voting. Democrats tend to take advantage of early voting sites. The historical trend, Democrats are participating at a lower rate now than they have in the past, which means Republicans are looking at this saying, do we have something here? But then you have, again, that unaffiliated block, and nobody knows where they're going to go.
Got to go to Glenn, then to Eric. I'm sorry, Eric.
I think you hit on something there, Mike. Though more people are registering as independents, when you dig deep, you do find that they tend to vote one way or another. There are very few people out there who are truly independent, who may vote one way one election and another way. Even those who are registered independent tend to be either dominantly Republican or dominantly Democratic. I think this is still a Democratic city, and I say that based on the history of the at-large races. Those are the races where you have to run citywide. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long it's been, but it's been a very long time since a Republican has been able to win one of the at-large races. And I think that's a barometer of where we are as a city, just as much as anything.
Eric.
Yeah, I was going to pick up on what you're saying, Glenn. That's exactly right. It's not that the unaffiliateds are a mystery. I mean, people tend to vote with one party or another. They just don't want the party label like they once did. So that's what's happening there. And then you're right. I mean, when you look at city council, it's been 9-2 in terms of a Democratic majority pretty consistently here the last few years. So that tells you that Democrats remain pretty strong. But the last point I would make, what can flip this and what might make Kenny Smith a successful candidate is the fact that 80% or so of the voters don't vote in these kinds of elections. So that's the real wild card, is who's actually going to show up. And that's why you hear all of us spouting the dreaded cliche of it's about turnout, because it is.
Right, it is. And
that's what struck me when I was watching the debate, and I was kind of flashing back to just 1 year ago when we were all glued to our TV screens watching the presidential debates. And that was a really visceral experience. Almost everybody watching that really disliked one candidate or maybe both candidates. And these are a couple of, you know, pretty intelligent, respectable people who won't be an embarrassment. And that's probably great for Charlotte, but does it have that visceral, right, motivating factor? I mean, it's one thing to answer a phone poll or to raise your hand at the brew pub, but like Eric said, most people don't go out and vote. And so who's going to have that oomph to say, I'm going to get out there and vote for or against?
Here's something else that came out of that Spectrum poll that I thought was interesting. It shows that Vi Lyles has more support from women. Smith has men in his corner. Black voters back Lyles 2-1. White voters back Kenny Smith 2-1. What does that tell you about Charlotte voters?
It follows a national trend.
Does it?
It really does. And, you know, we've talked a lot about Kenny Smith. We've talked a lot about the ads. You know, one thing we haven't mentioned is the fact that if Charlotte elects Vi Lyles, she will be the first African-American female mayor in Charlotte's history. And when you've got a voting bloc like African-American women who, and I know this is a broad statement, I always qualify it because not everybody fits so neatly into a little definable packet, but African-American women tend to vote Democrat. To be able to vote for one of their own for the top job in the city, that's something. Yeah. And that's not to be diminished. But overall, this is again, part of the polarization of American politics. It's not that surprising to me.
So we have a lot of races to talk about, the most important race being the school board race,
that's
according
right
to Ann Dawes-Helms, who says it's more important than the mayor's race. And when you come right down to it, it probably is, particularly if you have kids. And whether or not you have them, I suppose that's true. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about city council races, even some races outside of Charlotte, as the local news roundup special election edition continues from Birdsong Brewery in Noda.
You're listening to a special pre-election edition of the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup, recorded last night at Birdsong Brewing in Noda. More in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, committed to bridging the gap between a big bank and a small one, offering commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Details at southstatebank.com. And from Carolina Renaissance Festival, a storybook village and artisan marketplace with entertainment for all ages. Saturdays and Sundays, now through November 19th. More at renfestinfo.com. On the next Charlotte Talks, a deep dive into some of the events and stories that may have political ramifications, from elections to the new GOP tax plan to the Robert Mueller investigation. That's Monday Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, New York terror attack, Mueller's first charges and a guilty plea, GOP tax plan, social media giants grilled by Congress, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues. It's On Point, coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. We're coming to you from Birdsong Brewery in Noda. It's a pleasant Thursday evening, so if you're listening to it on Friday morning, you can crack open one. It's okay. Everybody else is doing that here, but not us. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. I don't know if we have enough any statistics at all yet on early voting. These are off-year elections. Turnout is always tiny. It hinges on a very small number of voters. What has early voting turnout been like?
The early voting, I checked this afternoon, it was 22,000 and change have voted early.
Is that good, bad, or indifferent?
That is higher than 2015 when we had about 18,000 voted total. Remember, we go through...
Is that a predictor of turnout on Tuesday?
Don't know.
Yeah, and we still have two more days to go, so This is not a final.
Right.
So are most people going to the polls because of the mayor's race or the other races? We have a lot of city council and school board races. Do we know? We don't know. Both of the candidates for mayor will leave their seats on city council open. Whether they win or lose, they'll lose their seats on council. So is Kenny Smith's seat at risk of going to a Democrat, or will it stay in Republican territory? Do we think? And we'll talk about the district races.
Well, this is one of them. This is District 6. This is South Charlotte. It's a pretty Republican area. I mean, there you've got the Republican candidate, Tarek Scott Bakari. He's facing a Democrat, Sam Grundman. And, you know, honestly, I think it's a pretty safe prediction that the Republican will carry District 6. What to watch for in that race is not the overall winner because we talk about gerrymandering all the time, but gerrymandering happens at all level of government, and it happens by both parties. The districts in Charlotte are drawn specifically to benefit, you know, Democrats in certain areas and Republicans in other areas. This is a Republican-drawn district. And
who drew the district, by the way? Since we're talking about – we've been doing a lot of talking about legislative districts.
It's done through the city. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the problem with gerrymandering is both sides do it all the time. So I think it's fair to say that Kenny Smith's seat will remain Republican. I think he's, you know, I'm not going to outright predict it, but I think you have to consider Tarek Scott Bakari, the Republican, the odds-on favorite,
right,
unless there's some kind of a major change. What to watch for there is the number of votes the Democrat gets and compare that to the past, because Sam Grundman could, you know, while I think it's a long shot that he would win, it would certainly be an upset. South Charlotte, like the rest of the city, is changing. You've got lots of new people moving in. So that will give you a better barometer of overall how the city is shaping up and overall whether Democratic or Republican issues are better being sold to that key unaffiliated block.
I tend to agree with Tom. I'm not expecting a lot of movement in terms of party balance on city council. And though I question the closeness of that spectrum poll, something about that just doesn't seem right to me. The mayor's race may actually end up being the most intriguing. The other one is will Dimple be able to pick up that fourth at large seat for the Democrats? But other than those two, I don't think there's going to be many. There will be many surprises when we wake up to Wednesday morning.
I think the thing that's interesting is that you have at least 5 of the 11 council members will be new, and obviously you bring in a new mayor, you have the issues that we've all been talking about, whether it's transit, transportation, public safety,
affordable housing,
all those things, and you bring in a new council, you know, a pretty heavily inexperienced council, so that can make for an interesting dynamic as well.
So let's talk about the at-large races. There are 8 candidates, 4 seats on city council, 4 Democrats, 3 Republicans, 1 Libertarian running. 2 of the people running are Democratic incumbents, Julie Eiselt and James Smudgy Mitchell. She's running on public safety, affordable housing, bike lanes, mass transit, among other issues. What is Mitchell focusing on?
Glenn. James Mitchell is the head. I'm sorry, Glenn, I didn't mean to cut you off. He's traditionally been about economic development. I mean, he's head of that committee, so he's been involved in a wide range of projects, including
soccer,
including soccer, but also diversity in terms of vendors, resetting, reestablishing that policy. So I think you'll hear James continue to talk a lot about economic development.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
All right. Well, then there are two other Democrats running. You mentioned one already, Dimple Ejmera, and also Braxton Winston. Ejmera is an unelected incumbent who was appointed to fill John Autry's seat when he went to the North Carolina House. Winston, of course, is a newcomer. Would it be safe to say that the voters' awareness of both of those candidates are because of either something they said or did in the recent past?
You could say that about almost every politician, frankly, but yes, to answer the question.
Particularly,
no, you're right. Well, I understand what you're getting at, and the answer is yes.
Let's say it, because people may not understand that.
Sure.
Dimple Ejmera has said some very provocative things in the last several months, and of course Braxton Winston was very active in the unrest that followed the Keith Lamont Scott shooting.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, Dimple Ejmera made the comment over the summer that no one who supports Donald Trump should be elected to local office. So that got some people's attention. And Braxton Winston was very famously photographed with his shirt off protesting after the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott. So, yeah, absolutely. A lot of their political relevance is due to those circumstances.
So what have they been talking about during the campaign?
Well, Ejmera, That's a little bit of a tricky one, because there was also a second controversy that dealt with whether or not the Charlotte City Council should pass a stance about Confederate monuments in the wake of Charlottesville. Her campaign post-primary has been to try to walk some of the back and focus on the economic development that she has done in District 2. To step back from the Trump controversy to make sure that she can appeal citywide and focus on what she's actually done on the council. Winston's an interesting case because, and both of these candidates, by the way, are millennials, which is something that we're going to see. Currently, Ejmera is the only millennial on city council, but both of them are kind of taking a different tack. Ejmera is pretty much a straight ahead classic campaign. Winston is really focusing more on social media. He's really focused. I mean, he has the mailers, he's knocking doors and making phone calls, don't get me wrong, but his approach has been more that classic let's get out with social media, trying to get his message out directly that way. I'm very curious to see if that works, because we haven't seen it on a city level quite the way he's doing it. He just came out with one on, I don't know if people saw it, the Halloween one that he put out. It's clever. It's catchy. And I want to see if it does, in fact, take with voters.
Well, it would certainly seem to probably work with millennials who would identify with him already. And we have
the
more
problem is they don't vote.
Yeah.
The problem is they don't vote.
Millennials who won during the primaries won because of us old folks.
But maybe that's because people don't talk to them, perhaps. Maybe he's talking to them.
Well, I will say this. You know, during this campaign, there have been more millennial-focused forums and meet and greets, and they're usually at a place a lot like this. So I think people, in terms of candidates, have been reaching out to millennials just based on what happened in the primary. They simply did not turn out, which is interesting also because we have a generational shift going on council that's bringing in some millennials, but it's being driven by older voters.
But even though they didn't turn out, he came in, what was it, second or third?
Second, I believe.
Second. He was able to come in second, so that says that even among the older voters, there's someone out there who's identifying with him as a candidate. He certainly wins the race in terms of the number of yard signs that are out. They're everywhere,
and they've been out for months.
They have been,
and we saw that with Larkin Eggleston and Patsy Kinsey. Another example.
Who are the three Republican?
Well, before you, we haven't mentioned Julie Isalt, who is the fourth.
I mentioned her.
You did mention her.
Go ahead and talk about her if you want.
She's probably the leading contender. I thought we had skipped over her, but I think she's probably pretty well known.
I mentioned her name. That's what that was the extent of it. Who are the three Republicans running at large?
Well, you've got John Powell, and he's running for the second time for an at-large seat consecutively. He actually just missed out on the council. He lost to Smudgy Mitchell by just around 250 votes. Right. So he was epically close.
Yep.
He's trying to build on that name recognition. Then you have Parker Keynes, another millennial. And you know, the Republicans tend to be running, they've almost got a unified platform in the city. It's crime prevention, economic development, and sticking to kind of basic government. Those are the things they will tell you when you ask.
Yeah,
the third candidate is kind of an interesting character. David Rice is something of a perennial candidate, I think it's fair to say. He has run for mayor, city council a couple different times, Mecklenburg County Commission. Has no website. I've not seen him anywhere. I've reached out to try to get him to join, you know, surveys and things like that that we do about all the candidates. Never heard back. So he's there, but I can't tell you much about him.
And we have a libertarian on the ballot. Stephen DeFiore, is that how you say his name?
Correct.
What do we know about him?
Well, he is a... he actually took part in this audio voter guide that we're putting together, or that we have put together. And his big pitch is, look, we know what Republicans say. We know what Democrats say. We know they don't tend to work together well. I'm a libertarian. I don't have a choice. I need to make sure that there is another way, and I want to represent it in Charlotte. The trick with that is it sounds catchy, but the Libertarian Party has never really taken hold here. Of all the candidates that are on the ballot in Charlotte or in Mecklenburg County, I know of only two Libertarians out of all of them. So it would be an epic surprise if DeFiore made.
So we did a whole program, really, on city council and school boards. I'm going to race through some of these. There are four district to city council races. District 2 pits Democrat Justin Harlow against Republican Pete Givens to fill Al Austin's seat in what is a Democratic, has been a Democratic district in the north and western part of the town. District 3 has incumbent Democrat LaWanna Mayfield going for her fourth term against Republican newcomer Daniel Herrera. District 6, which we talked a little bit about, South Charlotte Republican Tariq Bakari, Democrat Sam Grundman, and Libertarian Jeff Scott, all hoping to succeed Kenny Smith. And in District 7, Republican Ed Driggs seeking his third term in a southern district facing Democrat Sharon Roberts. Very quickly, sum up those races, those candidates. What do we need?
Wow,
to know?
Speed rounds. Well, yeah.
Other than those districts, what do you need?
I would just offer you that. I guess I would start with the blanket statement, which is I don't expect a lot of change and movement in terms of the makeup of the partisan split on council. In other words, I think Democrats are probably going to hold a similar margin to what they have right now.
So, if we have different faces but the same Democrat-Republican split, what does that mean for the politics of the council?
I think it's too early to tell. As we talked about with Dimple Ashmeer and Braxton Winston, assuming they're elected, I think they could bring a different type of governance to Charlotte. I think they could raise issues that some of the older candidates, some of the older elected officials might not want to tackle. I think it could be interesting to see a couple of millennials actually on city council.
Do you think that will millennials take a different point of view or have different interests other than the ones we've been seeing council focus on in the recent past?
I think Braxton Winston in particular will be interesting to watch how he balances what has been, as part of Charlotte Uprising, a very strong stance on basically defund the police, you know, be extremely skeptical of the police. If he joins the council, he's going to have to be part of the body that is overseeing the police and making decisions. And so I think he will be fascinating to see how he strikes a balance.
I could be wrong here. I don't think Winston himself has made those statements. I think that's more about Charlotte Uprising overall.
Okay, yeah, you may be right that that's been part of the group. But
just to clarify. But
certainly he's been very adamant about police reform.
Sure.
I think it's safe to say. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I think, you know, just getting back to the core of your question, I think honestly, Mike, whether it's millennial or baby boomer or Gen Xer or what, the defining factor goes back to the top of the ticket. I mean, there are very few things that Charlotte's mayor actually has power to control. They only can vote in a case of a tie. Yes, they have a veto. It's rarely used. But what they can and do is set the agenda. They decide what the council is going to talk about, and that will have more influence than just a generational divide.
And also, they...
I like the backbeat I just had there. That worked out perfectly.
Nice. That's not bumper music. We have plenty of time.
That's the new theme to Candidate Me. the other thing, though, is that the mayor, of course, also appoints the heads of the committees, and those heads of the committees are deciding what happens there, and that's, of course, where the action really starts in terms of a lot of these major projects.
Okay, put on your track shoes. Here we go. School board races. We've talked about this before, and you say, understand that these are more important than the mayor's race. Are people following these races? Do voters really pay attention to the school board?
I would love to think they do. I have done a whole lot of interviews at the polls and afterward when people show up and say, oh, I really care about schools. You know, I'm voting for the mayor who will be the best for education. Oh, do we have a school board race? So I remain eternally optimistic that they are reading every word that I write about this and making informed decisions.
And these are nonpartisan races. Does that make it more difficult for voters to decide who their favorite candidate is because it's not listed as a Republican or a Democrat?
It's not, although both parties, I think, are circulating material, right, as are some groups that have endorsements. So I'm kind of looking at this, the big overarching theme of the school board race and of the bonds is how much of a vote of confidence is there for Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools doing things the way they are versus how much is there a throw on the brakes and do something different.
So we've done a whole show on this too, so I want to go through these really quickly. District 1 is the northern part of the county. It's incumbent Rhonda Lennon against Danette Albright, Amy Hallman, and Jess Miller. Although Hallman's name is on the ballot, she withdrew from the race. What's the key issue there? Is it just the bonds, or is there more to it?
It's bonds, it's growth, it's that suburban identity. And if I can jump out of the order, I think one of the interesting things in there is that both District 1, which is north suburbs, and District 6, which is south suburbs, have kind of a traditional candidate. Rhonda Lennon is the incumbent there. She's a Republican. Paul Bailey is the designated, or excuse me, Sean Strain is the designated successor for Paul Bailey, who's not running because he's running for mayor of Matthews. So likely those two will be reelected, but both of those races have challengers who are significantly more liberal, progressive, more less focused on strictly the suburban schools and more focused on the bigger picture and some of the schools in Charlotte. If you were to see either of those districts flip, I think that would be a significant shift in school board philosophy.
I believe you said to our producer that they're more focused on equity and diversity than the folks who have typically been elected in those districts. Is that resonating with people in those districts, do you think?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to what Tom said about potentially newcomers moving into the suburbs. My prediction would be that you will see Rhonda Lennon reelected and Sean Strain elected to that seat. But this could be a sign of if you are seeing enough newcomers, enough shift in philosophy. It would be, I think, a big headline if those districts changed philosophy significantly.
Strain has four kids in CMS, and he likes neighborhood schools.
He does.
And Mr. Strange has, what, two children who aren't old enough? The other way, Mr. Smith. He has two children who are not old enough to go to schools, and he advocates choice.
Okay. Controlled choice, which is a different thing. Yeah, he is the progressive. He is the, you know, let's do away with the neighborhood school boundaries. That's going to be a tough sell in District 6.
Okay, quickly, there are in District 2, it pits incumbent Thelma Byers Bailey against Lenora Shipp. This district will benefit from the bonds if they pass. Bailey seeking her second term. Shipp's a former CMS principal. We'll find out what you think about that race when we come back. It's a cliffhanger. It's a cliffhanger. We're coming to you from Birdsong Brewery in Noda. The weekly news roundup special election edition continues in a moment.
More of a special pre-election edition of the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup recorded last night at Birdsong Brewing. Support comes from WFAE members in the Charlotte Regional Partnership, which markets the 16-county, two-state region known as Charlotte USA to companies looking to expand or relocate in our market. Information about supporting the effort at charlotteusa.com. And from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, providing members with Blue Connect, a suite of online tools that bring cost transparency to healthcare, enabling patients to make choices that meet their needs. Coming up at 10 o'clock on Point, the news roundup continues. A New York terror attack, Mueller's first charges and a guilty plea, a new GOP tax plan, and social media giants grilled by Congress. The roundup continues with On Point coming up next at 10.
Tuesday is Election Day, and there are big changes in the works. So WFAE is kicking off our coverage with something a little different. Join me, Tom Bullock, and the political consultants featured in our Candidate Me podcast for the night's news, the returns, and your phone calls. Tune in and call in to WFAE's live election night special, Tuesday from 7 to 8 p.m.
We're back at Charlotte Talks from Birdsong Brewery in Noda on a Thursday evening, even though you're listening on a Friday morning. We're just having water. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. So we're talking about the school board races, District 2, Thelma Byers-Bailey, the incumbent, against Lenora Shipp. A lot of newcomers to that area. This is an area that would benefit from the bonds. What do we need to know if we live in District 2?
We know these are both candidates who have deep ties to the area, both have experience of different sorts, not dramatically different philosophies. Again, I'm going to go with probably if Thelma Byers-Bailey wins, that's sort of a sign that people are more or less happy with the way things are. And if they flip to a challenger, that may be a sign that they want to see some change.
District 3 has six people in the race, the incumbent, Ruby Jones, who was appointed, so she's not elected. She was appointed to fill Joyce Waddell's seat when she went to the state Senate. So nobody in this race has been elected. Is she well-known enough to benefit from incumbency?
I think that's an interesting question, and she is an older candidate, so this is a mix of candidates who are kind of the traditional path of, you know, long-term involvement and not much social media, and some younger candidates who also in many cases have been involved with the schools but are campaigning in a very different way, as we've talked about.
Longtime school board member Tom Tate is stepping down in District 4, so there's no incumbent in that race. He's backing Carol Sawyer, who is running against Queen Thompson and Stephanie Sneed. Quick primer on those candidates, how they reflect voters in District 4 and what they might be looking for.
Carol Sawyer is a long-term activist. Some of her causes have been doing away with standardized or reducing the burden of standardized testing, and more recently with student assignment, promoting a plan that goes more heavily toward diversity. That would certainly be something that people would be looking for as they move forward with student assignment. Stephanie Sneed is a newcomer, but has gotten some good endorsements, seems to be impressing some people who meet her. Queen Thompson is on her third run, is a former CMS employee, has not won previously. We'll see if she can nudge the needle this time.
Okay. District 5, one longtime incumbent, Eric Davis, also stepping down, leaving that seat, former chairman of the board of the schools. That leaves the field to Margaret Marshall, Jim Peterson, and Jeremy Stevenson. What sets them apart?
Margaret Marshall is an unaffiliated voter. She is the designated choice of Eric Davis. She's probably the more traditional District 5, has raised a lot of money, has gotten a lot of endorsements, has been deeply involved with the schools. Jeremy Stevenson is a Republican, has gotten some pretty big endorsements from Republican elected officials. He has one child who is actually in a charter school. He ran 2 years ago and fell just short of the votes needed to get an at-large seat, so he is trying again at a district level.
So potentially, how many new faces could we end up having on school board?
We will have at least three. Could have six.
Could have six. And we have a brand new superintendent. Next year, we'll have a new school assignment plan rolling out. Will this change things? If we have a big turnover on the school board, could we see things change? Could we see the student assignment plan get put on hold?
There's not any one issue where, you know, people are running to let's start over with this or anything like that. But I do think that we are not really going to see Clayton Wilcox's full agenda and leadership style until this election, because I think we've had some that come in as kind of the super salesman and it's all about me, and this is his fourth superintendency. He is very conscious that he works for an elected board. So I think he has certainly been getting out and meeting people. I think he is now pretty much a positive in favor of the bonds, but he's been kind of waiting to see who he's going to be working for.
If the school board races are more important in your mind than the mayor's race, where would you put the school bond referendum?
If the bonds are defeated, I think we're going to see a huge scramble to figure out what on earth does this mean and where do we go from here? Because bond votes are always partly about the specific projects and plans that are being touted and partly about what do we think about CMS. And they tend to pass. We've had a poll that showed strong support for this. Like I said, I think Clayton Wilcox is a plus. I think you have people who really want to see their projects approved, but we've also seen some signs of trouble. We've seen some suburban towns and chambers of commerce saying they're encouraging a no vote.
Yep.
We're seeing some people voting with their feet. We've seen Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools enrollment kind of level off, and they've been losing black and white families, which tend to be people who participate more heavily in elections like this. The growth has been from Hispanic families who tend to not turn out in large numbers for this kind of election.
So we've talked about the bonds a lot, but bonds are always something that people walk into the ballot box and go, oh, what are these? They're bonds. What does this mean? So very quickly, what do these bonds do? What will they do if we say yes?
It will give the county commissioners authority to borrow $922 million. It is not legally binding, but they have a list of projects that includes, I believe, 10 totally new schools. And I didn't write these numbers down in front of me.
17, you've got 17 new schools, renovations or additions to 12 others, and it will relieve overcrowding, according to CMS, system-wide.
Yes.
Although people in the north would take issue with that.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's always the question of, is this the right package? And again, most people walk in not actually knowing what the specific projects are, but if you feel like you've been shortchanged, you may walk in feeling like, I'm going to send CMS a message. That may be true also. Again, I think most people were not feeling terribly traumatized by the student assignment decisions, but if you feel like your neighborhood or your school got the shaft in student assignment, you may be walking in to send them a message.
So these allegedly have overwhelming, it's been described as overwhelming support in most of the county, but not in the north. The Lake Norman Chamber of Commerce and the towns of Huntersville and Cornelius have said, don't vote yes, vote no on these bonds. And they claim years of neglect and a school board that has been perpetually out of sync, their words, with the growth taking place in the northern corridor. This is exactly what the West Side complains about, that they've been neglected for years. So who's right?
Well, you know, these things kind of move in cycles, and it's always a bit of a time lapse that they're, when a bond gets approved, it takes a while to actually build these things, and meanwhile, other schools are getting older and other neighborhoods are going up, so there's another place that is suddenly overcrowded.
A lot of the opposition in the north, and I think Jim Puckett's opposition, Glenn, came from a little switcheroo that happened near the end of the whole negotiation about what was going to be in these bonds, which favors the West Side.
Absolutely. You ask who's right. I think you could argue that both sides are right, but for different reasons. They've both been neglected to some degree, but for entirely different reasons. We know that there's a lot of growth happening in the north, but the West Side has been neglected for a totally different set of reasons. We have schools that are overcrowded, but they're also dilapidated, and they need to be replaced. West Charlotte, for example, is one of the schools that would be replaced. So I think you could argue that they both have a case.
Wow. So if the bonds pass and the north side part of the county feels shortchanged, how quickly can that be addressed going forward? Can there be another bond issue in 2 years to address the problems in the north?
There could be, but I don't know that it would do a lot of good because you can only this isn't something where you get a big sack of money and you run out and start all the projects at once. And the county commissioners have committed to not raising taxes, so they want to dole it out slowly. What they could choose to do is to say, we know we're committed to these bond projects, but we will use another form of borrowing to do another couple of projects. And you could see pressure from either the school board and or county commissioners to do something like that.
Tom?
Yeah, I just want to add one quick thing on this. I think it's going to be very difficult for another bond to be put on the ballot so quickly for this simple reason. This is the second largest school bond issued, if it's successful, in the state's history.
$922 million.
And the largest in Mecklenburg County.
Largest, by far in Mecklenburg County. So I think it's going to be tough to do that. I think Ann's right. They could always do some other sort of, you know, calculation or borrowing, but no. I think it's going to be quite a few years.
Could this drive a wedge between CMS and the northern part of the county? Could we see something like what's going on in Matthews, where they're trying to have a municipally sponsored charter school system be set up in Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson?
I think the answer to everything in politics right now is that there could be a wedge with northern Mecklenburg County and the rest of the city. I mean, you look at transit and transportation.
But you can't get there anyway.
They're mad about that. They've kind of made that point. But, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, remember, like Ann's saying, typically these things pass with a pretty healthy margin. I think the last time a school bond was rejected was 2005, and they passed pretty easily in 2007 and 2013. So you would tend to think that the North is going to be frustrated by an approval of these bonds.
Well, let's talk about the North, because we have other races other than Charlotte in the North, mayors and or commissioners or boards will be elected next Tuesday in Cornelius, Davidson, and Huntersville. In Cornelius, Mayor Pro Tem Woody Washam is unopposed in his bid for mayor. Why did nobody run against him? Anybody know?
Well, the mayor, Chuck Travis, decided not to run again after he was a supporter of the toll roads. So I don't know why.
See
no
what
else
I mean?
But yeah, so everybody is running against the toll road now. That the competition is all on the town board of town commissioners as opposed to the mayor's race.
So there are also 5 2-year seats up for grabs on the Cornelius Town Board. 4 incumbents are running against 7 challengers for 5 seats, and one of the names that popped out to me, at least, as a newcomer, was Kurt Noss, mm-hmm. who has led the anti-toll road efforts in that part of the county, and he knew more about the toll roads than people from the state coming to talk on this program about the toll roads. He really did his homework. So what kind of race is that shaped up to be?
It's a good question. It's gotten contentious. I mean, you have Kurt Noss. We also have another someone else who's an anti-toll road activist who's running. Obviously, it remains a big issue in North Mech, but it's gotten contentious because a separate group, I found out from our reporter David Borax today, a separate anti-toll group shut down or archived their Facebook page because it got so contentious with developers going after Kurt Noss and his candidacy. So you're even seeing these, you know, kind of fractures in the anti-toll lane coalition, as it were.
Right.
It's, you know, we can always think about suburban races as being kind of, sometimes they can be blood sport, and this is one that's getting pretty bare knuckle.
Let's go to Davidson, a 3-way race for mayor there. Incumbent John Woods, challenger Rusty Knox, Laurie Venson also running. What do we know?
They're all pretty well known there. Laurie Venson is a former town commissioner. Rusty Knox is a lifelong resident and the son of a former longtime mayor. The current mayor, John Woods, is unaffiliated. Venson is a Republican. Knox is a Democrat.
Okay.
How that all shakes out, I do not know.
And in Davidson, there are 5 seats on the town board, 3 incumbents running against 10 people for 5 seats, one of whom is George Berger. He dropped out, though his name's still on the ballot. Why so many challengers? A lot of people want to be on the board up there.
Yeah, I mean, Davidson's growing, and this is a theme you're going to see in all the suburban areas. The big issues there really are growth and transportation. But, you know, one of the more interesting storylines, at least out of Davidson, is not actually the candidates, but a group that's backing 3 of them, and that's Save Davidson. And this is a group that originally formed to try to, you know, depending on your point of view, either save a park or a wooded area in town or stop a new development that would include affordable housing. They've moved over, and they're actually now endorsing 3 candidates. They've been sending out flyers to the point where someone anonymously sent a complaint to the State Board of Elections saying they should be registered as a political action committee. Save Davidson says, well, that's not fair. You're just trying to, you know, silence us. But they have now started to file, financial papers just
now,
in case.
Now, in Huntersville, John Anarella beat Jill McSwain, the former mayor, last time because of her support for the toll lanes and his lack of support. He's running unopposed for a second term. Nobody wants to go up against him. Obviously, nobody favors the toll roads up there. But
I think if you get an incumbent who's pretty strong, a lot of times people say, I'm going to wait till there's a vacant seat and I have a better chance at it.
And there are 6 seats on the Huntersville Town Board with 5 incumbents running against 6 challengers, plus one with his name on the ballot, William Hagler, who has since suspended his campaign. Is this likely to be a situation where one new person gets elected?
I don't know. I mean, it's always an open question. I'm not going to try to predict those races. I mean, you've got a couple of board members in Huntersville who have been on the board for at least 4 years. I think one, you know, seeking a 5th term. You know, Huntersville is a changing city, but I live in Huntersville. You don't see a whole lot of political activity. There are more yard signs out now than I've ever seen before. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what the message is behind the names on those signs, I don't think it's reaching out as much as it is in other places.
He's the reason we're doing this program on Thursday night, because driving into town on Friday morning, not possible for him.
Is there trouble on 77?
I think so. All this election season, this man right here in the plaid shirt.
The one who apparently can't get to work on time on Friday mornings.
Tom Bullock has been running a fake campaign. It's been dastardly. And sharing that experience on his podcast, Candidate Me. And in his pre-election episode, he's turned the table and focused on real candidates. The episode is called Candidate Them. You have actual candidates for the council, city council, telling you in 45 seconds or less why voters should pick them. Why did you turn it over to them?
Well, you know, I mean, it's fun. I launched the podcast just to have a little bit of fun, and because I think local races are really important, and I thought it was a chance to kind of dig into what goes on with campaigns and ads and all sorts of stuff that we are often – we see one side of it, but what's going on behind the scenes is important a story and really interesting. You know, I wanted to hear from the candidates themselves. One of the joys of public radio is we learn very early – that there's a power in hearing someone say something on their own behalf.
Yep.
So I just wanted to say, all right. So I set up a voicemail number, had them give us a call, and we've got, I think we ended up with 12 or 13 of the 17 candidates running in a contested race. So we did pretty well.
So in every episode, you've had political consultants on. You have done a series of fake campaign commercials, both pro and con.
Yes, attacking
what
myself.
What did you learn from all of this about running for office?
That's a really good question. A lot of the behind the scenes stuff, honestly. A lot of planning has to go in. I think the more interesting thing to me is we're very polarized politically. We love to talk about the other side doing all these dastardly things. The reality is both sides are using the same playbook. And I think it's important for voters to realize that and consider it.
And you can hear the Candidate Me podcast at our website, WFAE.org. It's been the pre-election edition of the Charlotte Local News Roundup from Birdsong Brewery in Nona with Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from the Q City Metro, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal.